Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The governor and speaker of the House have both pulled back on state executions. Governor DeWine is frustrated by a dearth of options for execution drugs. House Speaker Larry Householder is frustrated by the overarching cost of carrying out the death penalty. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Jackie Borchardt is Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Laura Bischoff is state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Welcome.
Hello, listeners.
Daryl Rowland is public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome, Daryl.
Good morning, Ann.
This is a big turnaround for Householder, right, Jackie?
Yeah, it was definitely something new. He was at a press conference about pay increases for professionals that work with folks with developmental disabilities. And my colleague Jesse Ballmer asked him afterward if, you know, what his thoughts were on this, years long debate that we've had in Ohio over our execution protocol. And, you know, he said, I'm less and less supportive of it. It's, it's expensive. It's expensive to go through the whole appeals process. It takes years, decades in some cases. And it's really hard to get the drugs to execute a prisoner. And, it's been every state. This is something that is not unique to Ohio. It's something that every state that still holds executions is dealing with. And, his conclusion was, is this really worth the hassle and the cost? And that's something that we need to think about.
Interesting. Yeah. This comes on the heels of earlier this year, Governor Mike DeWine kind of saying that he, first off, no more executions would go forward as long as the protocol was ruled unconstitutional by the federal courts, and they have to come up with a new protocol. And he has since delayed executions. And I think that, there's more of a willingness to take a look at the death penalty and say, is it cost effective? Is it a deterrent? Is it what we want to be doing, given all these other overarching issues? Back in 2014, Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor put together a task force with the State Bar Association, and they came up with, 54 recommendations on how to, they didn't approach the question about whether or not we should have the death penalty, but rather, is capital punishment administered fairly in Ohio? And they came up with all these recommendations, and the legislature is only taken on a handful of those. There's a bill pending in the legislature again to prohibit execution of people with serious mental illness if they exhibited it at the time of the crime.
Well, so what was the bottom line from that investigation that Maureen O'Connor headed? Is it administered fairly?
There are at least 54 problems with it. One would be execution of people with serious mental illness.
Okay.
Others would be geographical issues, training of attorneys that take on capital punishment cases, the ability of smaller counties to administer these or to prosecute these cases versus larger counties.
Wealthier versus less wealthy, yeah.
Correct. So, there was a whole slew of recommendations. And most of them didn't go very far.
So, Daryl, there's some logistical problems with the death penalty in Ohio right now, for sure. Then there's this report with 50-plus recommendations, which suggests that it's not meted out fairly. But overall, has support for the death penalty changed much in Ohio?
If you look at public opinion, it shifted just a little bit, but there's still, a fairly strong majority of Ohioans, according to the latest opinion polls that I've seen anyhow, that still support capital punishment. Now that's, there's of course, as in all polls, it depends on what question you ask. Mm-hmm. Do you not support capital punishment for the most serious crimes? Invariably, that gets well over 50%. However, if they are asked, do you support capital punishment over lifetime imprisonment with no parole, the latter, the imprisonment with no possibility of parole, always wins over mm-hmm. executing someone. And it's interesting, as Laura and Jackie both pointed out, the first questions that are arising, and indeed the current discussion is more is not really over the morality, if you will,
right.
the rightness or wrongness of should we be, as a state, killing people, executing people. But it's over practical issues. Speaker Householder mentions cost first up. And, you know, that in some ways that seems counterintuitive because you think, well, it can't be cheap to keep a person in prison for their natural lifespan. It's not, but you add up the cost of the incredible number of appeals, attorneys getting paid for a matter of decades in some cases. Yeah, that always adds up to be more expensive. Then the other practicality is, will anyone give us the drugs? Us being the state of Ohio, mm-hmm. these executions are done in our names, folks. Will anyone give us the drugs to carry out an execution? Most pharmaceutical companies these days are not willing to do that. Ohio had been getting them a little bit on the sly, if you will. We've been obtaining the drugs and, through our mental health and drug addiction agency here in Ohio. I don't think there was a disclosure of how those drugs are going to be used, but then the head of that agency would personally drive the execution drugs down to Lucasville, where the death chamber is, where they would be, you know, used for executions.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. We're talking about changing, shifting sands when it comes to the issue of the death penalty in Ohio. Right. So that's another issue I wanted to bring up was this is in court now and Ohio lawyers, you know, assistants attorney general are arguing this in court while the governor has said he put the kibosh on the protocol that they're still arguing in court to preserve. Okay, all right.
So we thought. My colleague Marty Schleiden has done a few stories on this. And there was actually an extraordinary, I don't think it was an order, I think it was a letter from the judge magistrate who's hearing this case over in Dayton. Basically to the attorneys saying, is your client aware of what you are arguing here in court? Because it seems to be about 180 degrees opposite of what he's saying in public. As Laura said, the governor declared, I think it's clear back to the beginning of the year at an Associated Press reporter's gathering.
Yeah,
that was in January.
Yeah, that he was, you know, that judge found it to be cruel and unusual punishment. Now, it's not unconstitutional because the U.S. Supreme Court declared, put a little extra step in there 2 or 3 years ago in a case out of Oklahoma, saying not only does it have to be cruel and unusual, but the person about to be executed has to demonstrate that they cannot provide an alternative. So there's a little extra step there. So while the judge in Ohio declared it cruel and unusual, which we think that violates the Eighth Amendment, game over. It's not game over now as far as constitutionality. Anyhow, DeWine says as long as that was the case, no more executions on his watch, and indeed mm-hmm. he has delayed several as the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction has tried to find an alternative for executions. They basically came back and said, we can't really, again, for the practical issues of we can't really get the drugs. So, okay, legislature, what's plan B here? You know, we've thrown out the electric chair. Do we want to bring that back? Can't do lethal injection, gas chamber, you know, all the kind of a grisly discussion. And they're talking about, let's have this discussion this fall. But at the same time, when that seems to be taken off the table, lethal injection, the state's attorneys continue to file these briefs with the right. federal court saying, you know, we would still use this if you found it to be constitutional.
Is it just sort of a robotic response, though, kind of, Laura?
Well, I think they're just doing it because they started doing it.
And
you know, the attorney general's office has to defend the laws of the state, and yeah. that's what they're doing. So it is kind of confounding because there's, you know, at the until the legislature changes the law, I think that's what they're going to do.
And do you think, Jackie Borchardt, that given the nebulous nature of public opinion on this issue, anybody's going to step up and actually do something about it?
Well, there's been legislation introduced every General
sure.
Assembly. And
by a Democrat, right?
Republicans have been on board as
okay.
well.
Right,
I'm thinking of
Nirajan Tani
and Representative Bill Seitz. both from Southwest Ohio, have expressed an interest in working on that legislation. And I believe, you know, there is a bill that Representative Seitz and he used to sponsor with Representative Antonio. She's now in the Senate to at least take the death penalty off the table for people with severe mental illness. That's kind of, you know, if we can't get that done, can you really get much further than that? But that is something that's on the table. And I think, you know, Speaker Householder's position is one that I think several Republicans could line up behind from a, you know, fiscally conservative point of view. Mm-hmm. Is this really worth the time and the money? And, you know, I think, too, you've got victims groups are becoming much more prominent in groups of victims and imposing it, right, yeah. And saying, look, you know, this really doesn't give the peace that it's designed to do, especially if you have someone who's on death row for 20 years. You know, when do you get that closure? You really don't. And that, you know, in Ohio, the death penalty is very subjective and is not consistently applied. And then, of course, there's a huge question of, are we really, you know, executing people who committed the crime? That's a question mark as well. You know, the Innocence Project has found people who have later then become exonerated because of new evidence or old evidence that was finally tested.
Completely exonerated, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's at least half a dozen.
Right. Yeah. And there's also, but there is another group, a pretty powerful group in Ohio, prosecutors who support the death penalty as a negotiating tool.
Yeah, and I think that's where the biggest support for the death penalty is with the County Prosecutors Association. It's a very powerful lobbying arm. You know, also I think that in the legislature, you know, lawmakers are kind of all over the map on this. You do have people like Nikki Antonio and Niraj Antani who have in the past sponsored bills to abolish the death penalty in Ohio. But then you also have Representative Scott Wiggum who introduced a bill or talked about a bill to use confiscated fentanyl as the drug to...
Which the governor's put the kibosh on any...
Right, but I mean, that illustrates how they're not of one mind on this at all.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News. Also with us, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Summertime means summer movies and movie music. I'm Jennifer Hambrick. Join me for a new season of Sound Reels, Classical 101's film music podcast. Explore moving musical storytelling and award-winning film scores by some of the world's top film composers. You can find the latest episodes of Sound Reels at wosu.org/classical101podcasts or by subscribing to Classical 101 Podcasts on your preferred platform.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Governor Mike DeWine last week established the Ohio School Safety Center to centralize how the state detects and addresses threats. He said the new center will add to what schools are already doing.
What I have to look at is, while each of our over 600 school districts and over 4,000 buildings or so, each one of them is doing what they think is best and what fits their community, and we don't want to get in the way of them doing that. But what we look at is, how can we be value added? And we think that this center is value added as we move forward.
Okay, so how is it value added, Jackie Borchardt? How are they not getting in the way?
So the center is initially staffed with 7 employees who are being pulled from other agencies. I believe from Homeland Security and the Department of Public Safety. And there is some, I guess, new like software being purchased for the purpose of being able to monitor these social media sites and places on the internet where, you know, people may be leaving threats. And it's not just threats. I think it's important to know it's not just threats about, you know, potential mass shooting at a school, but related to student safety in all aspects. If someone, you know, is in danger of hurting themselves or hurting other people. That's kind of the most active role I think the center is going to take. They're also going to be in charge of reviewing all the school safety plans, emergency plans, which you'll remember a few years ago, there was kind of a big deal in that not every school had one as they were required to have. And there were some major problems with some of the ones that were filed. So this the idea is the center is going to be more of a resource for schools so that they're not, you know, trying to find this information on their own or from other sources, that this can kind of be a clearinghouse for that. And I know the school districts that have, you know, responded to this news have been really, they say it's supportive and it will help them.
Okay. And how much is it going to cost? I mean, what are we talking about here? Is there any details yet?
I asked about costs last week. They didn't have a detailed breakdown. Like I said, you know, initially it's seven people being pulled that already are employed by the state, so they're not anticipating a personnel cost at this time. Of course, they envision this center expanding, and then of course a cost for the software, but not in terms of you know, a big multi-million dollar price tag at this point.
Mm-hmm. The districts are supportive of it. Does it fit in any way with the governor's 17-point gun control proposal at all?
Yeah, I think this is part of his overall package. You know, he's talked about, you know, increasing access to mental health services, and that's going to come through the $625 million in wraparound services that got put into the state budget for K-12, which would expand mental health services and after school programs and a bunch of other things for schools. And then I'm hearing that, you know, he's going to be introducing legislation for comprehensive background checks and also a red flag law soonish. A red flag law is, you know, allowing either or both close family members and law enforcement to seek a court order to seize weapons from somebody who seems to be exhibiting signs that they're a danger to themselves or to others. Mm-hmm. There are 17 states have these laws, including Indiana. Indiana has had it for quite a long time. Florida adopted its after the shooting in Parkland. And there's a lot of thought that the red flag law would also help prevent suicides.
Actually, more so.
Sure,
in many ways, yeah.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, 60% of gun deaths in America and in Ohio are
self-inflicted.
By suicide.
Yeah, right. At his announcement for the school safety center, the governor responded to a question about Speaker Householder's concern that the gun control proposal would be a hard sell. Let's hear what the governor had to say.
I understand a natural skepticism, but I think when people see the facts, they're going to look up and say, that works. We can do it. As I said, there's nothing that I have proposed that I don't believe this legislature can pass and will pass.
Daryl Rowland, is he being Mr. Positive, or is there some substance to back this up, or what?
I think at this point both are true, Anne. But I think everyone's kind of put their finger on perhaps the key player in this debate, and that's Speaker Larry Householder. You know, a year and a half ago, he somewhat famously, to at least Political Insiders, made a TV ad blowing up a TV set with a gun. So he has been endorsed by every gun rights organization that I know of. And in fact, he specifically pledged during his reelection campaign last year to oppose red flag legislation. So he will have to, if he's going to now support it, that's going to be a change of position, one which he will have to explain to his supporters. You know, people don't like to do that. So we shall see. We're sort of at that key point here. They say that the outrage, if you will, the will to do something from these mass shootings, unfortunately, kind of dies out. It's a poor choice of words. Evaporates in 3 weeks after it happens. And that's about where we are in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And, of course, somewhat conveniently, the legislature's been on summer break. You know, they've still got two or three more weeks before they're coming back to town. Will that will to do something lessen, even though it happened right here in Ohio? And that's where, you know, people like Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, that was mentioned before, you know, she has pledged she's going to work in Columbus and try to make it so we don't have the do something chance do not go unanswered.
Hmm. Laura Bischoff?
Yeah, I think that the Daryl's right. Larry Householder is the pinch point on this. If he put it on the floor for a vote, it would likely pass. Depends on how red flag law is constructed. I think that it has an easier chance in the Senate. Peggy Lehner, a Republican from Kettering, she's the chair of the Senate Education Committee. She has signed on to Democratic bills seeking gun control measures already. I think Stephanie Kunze also signed on. So that's 11 votes right there now in the Senate, and they need 17. So they're closer in the Senate than they are in the House.
I know that there was a big party in Dayton last night.
So, Dave Chappelle lives in Yellow Springs outside
of... Great comedian, Dave Chappelle.
He lives in Yellow Springs outside of Dayton, and he organized the Gem City Shine, and they had 20,000 people in the Oregon District where the shooting happened, and they had artists Jon Stewart, Chris Rock, Stevie Wonder, Chance the Rapper, Kanye West, and a whole bunch of other artists who I don't really know because I'm not that hip. But
what a lineup.
It was a great lineup, and it was a great way for the community to come together and kind of do some healing.
When Governor DeWine was in Dayton recently after the shooting, after the mass shooting, the audience was saying, do something.
Right, and it was on the same block where the vigil was held. And they
Was there any of that kind of activism, do we know, last night? Or was it just a celebration of life?
I think it was
survival?
A celebration. Yeah. Nan Whaley was on the stage also with Chappelle. It's interesting. Whaley, I've known her since she was in college. And she has, she's really garnered a lot of very positive national press on this. The Washington Post, the New York Times, the New Yorker have all done profiles on her.
Why do you think she has?
I think, you know, she's very Dayton, you know, like she's just really...
Matter of fact,
she's very personable. And I think that, you know, she doesn't mince words, and she has... she's called for more gun control. She's working closely with Mike DeWine. Mm. She and DeWine were texting, like after the tornadoes, the Memorial Day tornadoes, and then they've talked regularly on what measures should be pursued for you know, gun reforms.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Also with us, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Jackie, you know, Curious C-Bus is our semi-regular program. We asked people if they have any questions about gun control in Ohio and gun laws in Ohio, really. And today the topic was about how much gun rights organizations or organizations on anywhere on the continuum of the issue, how much they support politicians. And it's actually very little. There isn't a lot of money spent, like, say, by the NRA in Ohio, even at the congressional level, but they do spend a lot of money on ads. So how much influence do gun rights organizations have with politicians in the state? Is that much of a part of the equation?
Well, I think, yeah, they will spend money on ads, but I think even more so the larger influence that they have is through their email lists and through their ability to kind of gin up grassroots support for their positions or opposition to legislation and specific lawmakers. You know, they're able to kind of mobilize a lot of folks very quickly to
you know, send emails and letters and calls and kind of, you know, bombard politicians that they see who are opposing, you know, Second Amendment rights or want to put more restrictions on firearms. I mean, we even saw this just a couple months ago. There's a bill pending in the Ohio House to eliminate the concealed carry requirements and licensing and to be a permitless carry state. And that bill, an amendment was made to the bill that would require gun dealers to also provide a pamphlet on Ohio's gun laws. And a group, Ohio gun owners, kind of, you know, mobilized their opposition to that amendment and flooded the inbox and phone lines over at the Ohio House. And that was enough for House Speaker Larry Householder to pause action on that bill, at least for a couple of days, to kind of, you know, hear out their opposition to that amendment.
And whatever happened to it?
Well, it was pulled from the bill, and the bill was passed out of committee, but it is going to another committee this fall, which is very rare that a bill would go through two committees in the same chamber.
Yeah, I mean, practically speaking.
Yeah, I think Jackie's right. The power of the gun groups is really in that they can mobilize voters. They you know, they give an A to this legislator, an F to that candidate, and their voters are very dialed into this and, you know, use that information to inform how they vote.
We should probably mention a couple of things here, Anne. You know, Jackie mentioned about the license-free concealed carry, the proposal where no longer would training be required, no longer would you have to get a permit at the county level, as you do now. Despite the gun violence measures Governor DeWine has introduced, he still favors that. And he said he has not changed his mind on where he stands on the Second Amendment. And that I've not heard him say this explicitly, but he has always favored stand your ground legislation as well. Very controversial, of course. That's not even not been passed in Ohio. So he's certainly got some criticism for not for being a little what some would view as inconsistent. You're calling to crack down on guns over here, but you're going to allow no training people to carry concealed weapons. The other thing that he, at this point he's done nothing about is many of your listeners have probably heard about the case up in Morrill County in the Highland Local School District, a little tiny district in a very rural county, where a first grader got a hold of a gun, purportedly pointed it at a classmate, and this was the gun of, I think it was his grandmother, but so the reason she had a gun in a school was she was authorized by school officials to be one a teacher or a staffer to carry.
You're in the bus.
Yeah.
The bus crew,
to have a gun within school. And this was, you know, this is allowed in Ohio if the local school board approves it. And in fact, it's kind of a secret whether you can find out whether your own local school board has passed. So if you've got a first grader going to school, you may try, if it concerns you, you may not be able to find out whether that whether there are guns in the school that are being carried by staff members. Governor DeWine's, quite frankly, sort of whiffed on a question by my colleague Randy Ludlow about, well, should there be any sort of training or anything required there? And he just simply said he did not know. Right now, there's nothing required. And it's, again, it's something that varies all over the state. It's sort of a local control thing, which many would say, well, that's good. But sometimes there's the 8 hours concealed carry class. Sometimes there may not be any training at all.
You know, I think that the school boards have to vote publicly on whether or not they're going to allow staff members to be carrying. So, the problem is we have 613 school districts. It's not reported to the Department of Education which districts adopt those policies. So you'd have to file 613 public records requests to determine who.
I think they vote on whether publicly or whether or not they're going to have the policy to do it, and
correct,
then it's secret who is authorized or at least where
the
guns are.
But the policy itself, I think, may be under wraps, other than yes,
yeah,
we allow or don't we allow.
Right. Yeah.
But as to whether we're going to arm 20 teachers or two, mm-hmm, or what the criteria are, I'm not sure you can find that out. But that's one of the pressing issues, and I'm sure that will be talked about now that we have this incident where, thank God, nothing happened. But that's kind of shocking with, you know, a six-year-old handling a loaded firearm.
Former Governor John Kasich popped up in the news last week with former Ohio State University president Gordon Gee.
Yeah, the Kasich-Gee bromance continues.
Right.
They've been long allies.
They're calling on the state to use money from lawsuits against opioid companies, I guess from the payouts that will eventually occur, or they're hoping for, that they're calling for the money to be sent to hospitals. And I'm just trying to figure out what in the world? I mean, where did this come from? And
probably from the hospitals.
but we don't know.
Right. They formed a 501c4, which is a dark money group. They don't have to disclose their donors. Gordon Gee said in a conference call last week that the donors would be disclosed, but then John Kasich said, I'm not so sure about that. you know, it's going to be, you know. I
rolled my eyes just for the record.
Yeah, here we go.
Anyway, you know, they said that they want to educate the public and the policymakers that, you know, that the money should go to those who provided frontline care.
Well, like police officers.
Well, you could also argue it was cities that provide EMS and naloxone and, you know, jails that end up housing more people. And there's the
children that are left orphaned by
the foster care system that takes care of these kids whose parents are deep throes of addiction. I think that the hospitals are probably funding this 501c4 for them to talk about it. Gee, of course, is now the president of West Virginia University.
Is that the West Virginia University?
Probably University of West Virginia. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, they have a large medical center, and he talked on the conference call that, you know, they provide all this care as
well. So that's his interest in it. Does this mean that John Kasich's a lobbyist or Gordon Gee is a lobbyist?
No, they're educators. They're educating the public.
It's a social welfare group.
Are they getting paid to educate the public? We don't know.
We don't know. It's dark money.
That's interesting because the question you just asked, are they lobbyists, was something that Ohio's Attorney General Dave Yost tweeted when that announcement was made.
Oh, I'm echoing Dave Yost.
Yes, for better or worse.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the state's attorneys general want to have control over, you know, this money hasn't even been approved.
Right, right.
Okay, but they're thinking it's going to be billions and billions of dollars, and there's a fight already over control of who gets to,
whether it should
hand
be
it
the
out.
State, whether it should be these local jurisdictions that have actually filed suit, you know, against these companies. I don't know. I think it is a valid concern that many public health officials have that this money will not go toward remedying our, you know, the fallout from the opioid epidemic. If you look at the Master Tobacco settlement, from the late 90s, what happened to Ohio's share of that money? Did it go toward, you know, getting people to stop smoking and using tobacco?
For a little bit, but
then it went to, you know, paying for schools to be funded and patching budget holes.
And smoking rates shot up proportionately.
You know, it's interesting. John Kasich made that point. Like, he didn't want to see the money frittered away, like with the tobacco settlement. But, you know, during his last 2 years in office, I looked it up, and the American Cancer Society gave Ohio an F because it wasn't spending enough money on prevention and cessation programs, and that was under his budgets.
Do we know if he is getting paid to do this, or we don't? No one asked him if he's getting paid to represent.
He's a private citizen now, so.
Yeah.
See, now I thought you said John Kasich was in the news. I thought you were talking about his great return trip to New Hampshire that's coming up next.
I didn't know.
Next month.
Oh, it's coming up.
Yeah, and
well, he did pop into El Paso and Dayton. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, for CNN.
Yes.
Yeah. But as a private citizen. John Weaver is paid political consultant, $10,000 a month, not bad money, $8,000 a month for Beth Hansen, his old campaign manager.
Okay.
$5,000 a month for Jim Lunch, his old communication specialist. Wow. So all these people are still on the payroll of his campaign pack, which is bankrolled, by the way, by Abigail Wexler to the tune of $100,000. All that aside, he's gone back to New Hampshire. John Weaver is telling the Washington Post, you know, he's never ruled out challenging Donald Trump and all that. Well, I talked to some of the governor's, former governor's supporters in New Hampshire, and they're saying there is no way that this is going to happen. John Kasich has already said he's not going to be a sacrificial lamb, and that's what he would be at this point. Despite all the moaning and groaning about Donald Trump, some from Republicans, you know, despite Joe Walsh jumping into the race, the former congressman, not the former member of the Eagles and the James Gang, mm-hmm. Ohioans.
Just don't get excited.
Yeah, Mark Sanford, you know,
South Carolina.
Yeah,
former member of Congress.
Yeah,
South Carolina,
and right? Erstwhile hiker of the Appalachian Trail.
Right, that's right.
Who also said he was going to. He mixed up Iowa and Ohio.
He was glad to be back in the Buckeye State when he went to Iowa. So I think his prospects are zooming. Bottom line is Donald Trump has, even in New Hampshire, a notoriously independent state, 80% approval rate of Republicans. He has $125 million already that he has raised. John Kasich, by comparison, in all of the 2016 campaign, raised $19 million. So unless our former governor has found more than Abigail Wexler or a bigger sugar daddy is going to write a lot of six- or seven-figure checks, you know, it's just totally a dream.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. Some lawmakers are calling to end the statute of limitations on rape in the state of Ohio. Laura Bischoff, what's going on?
Yeah, so right now the statute of limitations is like after 20 to 25 years, depending on the circumstances. Prosecution cannot move forward on a rape case. There's also like this rolling 5-year period that if evidence is discovered, it extends the statute of limitations by 5 years. Nothing is ever simple in the Ohio Revised Code. The former attorneys general and Dave Yost all signed a letter. I don't think Mark Dan was invited on that letter, but he agrees with this. So it's all the living former attorneys general.
Except for maybe Mark Dan.
He released his own letter. He was not asked to participate, but he released
his
own letter.
Disgraced former.
They couldn't get his
general.
Address.
Yeah.
But anyway, they all say that should be eliminated. Mike DeWine has also said that the statute of limitations should be wiped out. Of course, he's a former attorney general. I think that there's some concern about wrongful convictions and wrongful accusations coming forward, you know, years and years and years later after memories have faded. With DNA testing, if there's a kit still sitting on a shelf somewhere from way back when, and somebody comes forward and says, you know, this did happen to me, then there's an argument that they should get justice. You know, bring the evidence forward and see what happens.
Who doesn't support that? Jackie Borchardt?
Well, I mean, defense attorneys, and public defenders are, you know, for the reasons that Laura just mentioned, you know, they're trying to get, fair treatment for their clients and that this may muddle with that. I think also, there's legislation pending that was specifically open it back up for the victims of Dr. Richard Strauss
of Ohio State.
And, you know, it was recently reported last week that, you know, the count is over 300 men, possible victims. And, I would guess that Ohio State does not want that to happen because that would be a huge, huge multi-million dollar liability for
them. Well, I mean, it's already going to be a bucket of money, a big bucket of money. But
keep in mind that there are statutes of limitations on both on the civil side that are small are shorter, and then on the criminal side, it's, you know, 20 to 25 years. And Richard Strauss cannot be prosecuted. He died by suicide back in 2005. But it's
the university that's up.
Right. It's more the university's exposure is on the civil side.
Okay.
Yeah. And there is a bill pending specifically to open up the look back window to allow lawsuits against the university for the Richard Strauss
I'm
victims.
Trying to figure
and it's very
out,
tailored.
Right, very tailored, but I'm trying to figure out what about the rights of others and anybody else who's been raped? It doesn't seem fair.
To tailor a
law specifically. You happen to have been assaulted by...
Yeah, sure, you can... You know that's going to be brought up, you know, among the first rounds of testimony. It's... You know,
other victims who weren't,
you know, victims of members of the clergy, what have you. We've all read stories about those and how many of them go back many years. It's like, well, and they, as Laura pointed out during our break, you know, that was an issue more than a decade ago, well over a decade ago in the legislature. That was opened up a little bit, but not as far back for victims of priests and what have you. But yeah, so why would you open it up for just the victims of one OSU doctor and not make it across the board? And yeah, that will get a lot of attention of a lot of powerful players at the State House if that happens.
Well, what else? Hey, you know, Jackie, something about the Supreme Court Justice, Justice DeWine?
Yeah, his wife filed for divorce on Friday. Second wife, and she is alleging adultery as part of that filing. You know, we reached out to both parties on Friday to find out a little bit more. Neither wanted to speak to us, but Justice DeWine issued a statement, you know, saying that, you know, he was not going to speak on it further out of respect for his family during this time.
But there is an interesting issue with the Supreme Court in terms of politics.
That's right.
It may be actually up for control next year, Democrats and Republicans. It's currently 5-2 in favor of the Republicans. It had been 7-0 or 6-1 for many, many years. Dems won both seats last year. Now Justices French and Kennedy are up for re-election next year, again, both Republicans. And already coming forward on the Democratic side are Jennifer Bruner. She's a Franklin County Court of Appeals
former Secretary
Judge,
of State.
Former Secretary of State. She's already been on the statewide ballot and been victorious. John P. O'Donnell, not the O'Donnell that has been on the Supreme Court, but he has run before, Cuyahoga County, I believe, Common Pleas Judge. Again, that name recognition as, you know.
I'm not even sure it's recognition. It just seems to be certain kinds of names, strictly Irish names.
Kennedy, O'Connor, O'Donnell,
I don't know what it is about
Donnelly.
Ohio. Brown.
Yes,
Brown's
and we may get to try Italian as well, because also one of the longest serving Common Pleas judges in Cuyahoga County, Judge Russo, is also talking about running for this as well. Democrats seem to ignore the Supreme Court for many years, and, you know, it came back to bite them on all sorts of issues from, you know, from ECOT to school funding to what have you. So now they're making a play for it, and it could really be important. You know, we had this whole new redistricting process that's taking effect in Ohio after the 2020 census. So if there are legal disputes on that, they would go to the state courts. Presumably they could work their way all the way up to the Ohio Supreme Court. So political control of that court could be very important come 2021, 2022.
So another interesting issue kind of on the horizon is this House Bill 6, the energy bill that was signed
into the nuclear bailout bill.
The nuclear bailout bill, however you want to call it. It passed, got signed into law, and there was a huge amount of money spent on TV ads, like $10 million to try to get this through the legislature. And there's a group by Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts. They're trying to collect 265,774 signatures by October 21st to put it on the November 2020 ballot as a referendum to repeal the law. And there's a new group, Ohioans for Energy Security. They rolled out their first ad, and they are The play on it is, don't sign that petition. It's the Chinese trying to control the energy grid.
Yeah, what is there any basis for that?
Well, in some ways, these groups bring it on themselves because they're 501c4s, as we talked in an earlier context. Mm-hmm. We don't know where the money's coming from, unfortunately. But to, I mean, speaking of money, this is the group that, you know, the group that needed the money to bail out the nukes. And they've got enough money to air an ad more than 14 months before an election would be held or a vote would be held.
They're trying to chill people from signing in the first place.
Say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, they're trying to keep people from...
They don't want it even to get to the ballot period.
There is just a limited window of time that the petitioners have to get enough signatures, valid registered voters, to get on the ballot. And, but hey, we might not even know what a registered voter is in Ohio anymore. We've had purges scheduled. One is scheduled for next Friday. And we have now discovered that another 1,600 plus names were on the purge list that shouldn't have been there. One way you get there is through voter inactivity. In this case, you haven't voted since, I think it's the 2013 primary. We went through the database of all those about to be purged. We found more than 1,600 who were on that list who have cast ballots. So they should not have been on the to be purged list. This is on top of an earlier finding of a few hundred more a couple weeks ago that should not have been on the list. As of now, the Secretary of State's office said, well, we found the problem, so we're going ahead with the purge. But many people, many Democrats have said, we need a timeout here, folks, to make sure we're getting this right this time around. Because it's a very volatile issue. I mean, you talk about voter suppression and all that.
Right.
And you do have to, you know, get the deadwood, so to speak, off the rolls. Voter maintenance is required. Voter roll maintenance is required by law. But when stuff like this happens, it just really erodes confidence.
Well, and this is just the latest in several years of reporting on how this process is not applied consistently across the state. A handful of years ago, the Enquirer reached out to all 88, because in Ohio, we have 88 counties. Each county has their own board of elections that administers elections within the county. So there's no, you know, while the Secretary of State is the state's election chief, each county runs their voter rolls. And, you know, what the Enquirer found a couple years ago is that you had some counties that were not purging anybody because they just didn't feel a need to. And then you had some who were, you know, much more aggressive in removing inactive voters from the rolls. So, you know, it's just Frankel Rose has called it an antiquated process. And that's why he wants to move toward something where you are more put on the rolls rather than, you know, an opt-out versus an opt-in system when you're registering to vote. Because right now, you know, you can never update your registration, your move, and that's where a lot of these are coming from. So, of course, someone who moves, who doesn't update their address with the Postal Service is not going to see that notice in the mail that's being mailed to their old address.
Mm-hmm.
The moral of the story is go check your voter registration.
Quick.
And you can do that on the Secretary of State's website. You can see if you're on the purge list or what your registration status is. And we should add that if you have moved, you know, now's the time. If you want to be eligible for this fall's election, you can update your registration right there, update your address or whatever. You know, and I think we should give, former Senator, now Secretary of State LaRose, credit for wanting to alleviate the need for at least such widespread purges by, as Jackie said, trying to make it where almost any time a citizen has contact with state government, where it's applying for welfare, getting a hunting or fishing license, at the BMV, whatever, that you are opting in to be a registered voter, unless you specifically say, no, I don't want to be, I don't want to serve on a jury, or I'm just, you know. Well,
anti-voting?
Yeah, just anti-voting. I'll take whatever the politicians dish out. I don't want a voice. That's pending legislation that has been introduced. Obviously, the secretary is supporting that. But it seems like I haven't really polled the legislature or anything, but it seems like that's something that could well get some support this fall when the legislature comes back.
Well, Darrell Rowland, thanks for your time to talk about it today.
Thank you, Ann. Great to be here.
Darrell Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Laura Bischoff, Dayton Daily News state government reporter. Thanks to you as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Jackie Borchardt, Columbus bureau chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.